Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It's carbon, cash, and Qatar this hour. Qatar has plenty of carbon in the form of natural gas these days. The energy-rich nation has plenty of clout and cash to throw around. And the question we'll explore this hour is whether Qatar's clout in international affairs, like taking Taliban prisoners off U.S. hands or the success of Qatar-owned Al Jazeera, might be besmirched by a scandal over evidence Qatar bought the 2022 World Cup competition. Also, the U.S. tries to regulate carbon emissions, federal edicts become state mandates, and cash for low-wage earners in Seattle, the $15-an-hour minimum wage, a socialist experiment in city politics. But the really big story over the weekend, of course, was a family reunion, a soldier released from captivity in Afghanistan in exchange for the release of Taliban prisoners sent to Qatar from U.S. custody in Guantanamo Bay.
This morning, I called Bob and Jannie Bergdahl and told them that after nearly 5 years in captivity, their son, Bo, is coming home.
I love you, Bo. I'm so very proud of you. And, of course, all of your very large family would also like me to tell you that they love you also and are also very proud of you.
Sergeant Bo Bergdahl's mother, Jannie, speaking at a news conference in Idaho after the president's announcement. But a former prisoner of war, surprisingly, had some questions about this release. Vietnam-era POW John McCain, now the senior senator from Arizona.
We're all grateful that he has returned. I think there are legitimate questions about these individuals who are being released and the conditions under which they will be released.
What does the Bergdahl release say about U.S. policy toward the Taliban and the conduct of the war in Afghanistan? Joining us now is David Sanger, national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. David, welcome.
Good to be back with you, John.
So what does this say here? You know, this deal is not necessarily something that came out of the blue. It was on the table years ago.
It sure was. And one of the interesting questions is why it wasn't struck in, say, 2011, which is when the discussions first came up. But, you know, John, when the discussion did first arise, it was in a very different context. Yes, everybody wanted to get Sergeant Bergdahl back, and that was a very urgent priority. But the idea of releasing the five senior members of the Taliban, one of whom had been the intelligence chief, one the defense chief, one with the blood of many thousands of Shia on their hands, is one that came about because the United States was trying to get into a broader accord with the Taliban that they hoped would lead to some kind of a peace process within Afghanistan. The idea at the time was that this would be a confidence-building measure, that you'd release five Taliban, you'd get Sergeant Bergdahl back, and the Taliban would be on the way to an agreement in which they would renounce al-Qaeda, they would work within the existing government structure of Afghanistan, and they would engage in a dialogue with the Afghan people. None of that happened. And in the end, when the deal was done this weekend, it was without that larger peace process involved.
I'm wondering if part of this has to do with the urgency with which the administration wants to resolve the question of the Gitmo inmates, in the sense that there's really no option for so many of them, and this was probably the only option to take care of five.
Well, there are three moving parts here. One of them was the urgency in getting back Sergeant Bergdahl. That photograph that was released earlier this year seemed to suggest that he was in declining health. The second urgency, I think, was to complete getting out of Afghanistan. And the president obviously was just there a week ago and announcing that by the end of the year, all troops except perhaps a token force, which would only be around for a couple of years, would be out. And then I think the third big issue is the one that you allude to here. And in this particular case, the difficulty of getting people out of Guantanamo is which people? So when this deal first was proposed in 2011, The then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mike Mullen, and the then Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, had very serious reservations about releasing these five, even if they were going to gutter for a year, because the concern was that they would be back in contact with other members of the Taliban, they could be leading operations remotely, and then eventually they would be repatriated.
So there's no confidence that these folks in Qatar are going to, you know, be, you know, working at the 7-Eleven there. The question is, they could actually use Qatar on some level as a base of operations.
And that has to do with what the limitations on their actions in Qatar are. And I think you heard Senator McCain refer to that. And his big worry there, and it's shared by many others, is are the restrictions that will be placed on them enough to keep them from being back in the fight, either in leadership positions or more directly?
So do you think John McCain's questions are legitimate and that this will have some sort of political legs as the debate over this goes forward?
Well, they're certainly legitimate in that they were not only John McCain's questions, they were shared by many members of the Obama administration. And while the administration may not be advertising those today, as everybody celebrates the return of Sergeant Bergdahl, and I think that's a great thing to certainly to celebrate, those issues will come back up. Some Republicans have declared there will be hearings. I think at this point, as Senator McCain said, what's done is done. The five are gone. Sergeant Bergdahl is back. So I think you'll see sort of two levels of investigations underway. One is whether or not the administration followed the law. Clearly, they decided not to do the required 30-day notice to Congress. And then I think the second question will be the circumstances under which Sergeant Bergdahl ended up getting captured, whether he had wandered off the base, as some have alleged. And there's a lot these days that you're hearing from former members of his battalion who were quite concerned about how he ended up getting into the hands of the Taliban and what kind of price the United States paid in the effort to try to get him back.
Well, the Taliban prisoners are now in Qatar, and Sergeant Bergdahl is on his way to being reunited with his family. David Sanger, national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So the Supreme Court has said that the EPA can regulate carbon as a pollutant, carbon dioxide, critical to the survival of plant life on Earth, but also the byproduct of fossil fuel combustion. And this week, the president will issue federal EPA carbon regulations forcing states to comply. The goal is to reduce carbon emissions by 30% by the year 2030. In our first look at this issue in a week-long conversation on carbon regulation and production, we turn to Susan Tierney, who served as the Assistant Secretary for Policy at the U.S. Department of Energy under President Clinton. She's now a senior advisor at the Analysis Group. Welcome, Susan.
Hi, John.
So do we expect that these regulations from the federal government will, in a sense, compel the states to really consider cap-and-trade programs on an individual state-by-state basis?
I don't think that that's the only answer that a state has in its quiver of tools. There are many states that are probably going to do that. We know a number of states already use cap and trade programs, such as those in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic area and California. But I think that one of the cool things about this rule is that it'll allow states to really find the appropriate pathway that they want to use.
Now, the Supreme Court has given absolute authority to the federal government and the EPA to regulate carbon. Is there any way that this can be challenged? States' rights have been a very big theme of the administration's relationship with Congress over the last seven, 6 years.
You're absolutely right about that. I think everybody who's following this rule, which comes out today, is assuming it will be challenged in court. The EPA has been well aware of that, I'm sure, and has taken great care to make sure that they are standing on strong legal ground when they're moving forward. But as I said just a second ago, this rule is really from a part of the Clean Air Act that allows such a cooperative, flexible approach that I think many of us are hopeful that this will withstand legal contest.
Who's going to have the most difficulty reaching these standards? And I suspect the coal industry is probably right in the crosshairs here.
Yes, I think you're right about that. I think that the coal mining and coal production and coal sales industry those are the groups that are going to be most concerned, although I think it would be wrong to assume that this rule will lead to a near-term elimination of coal from our power mix. Right now, coal makes up about a third to 40% of power production in the United States. Now that we have such cheap natural gas and plentiful natural gas, that's been eating into the coal, our use of coal anyway. So already coal is in some ways on the defensive. But I think many power companies and many states realize that there are lots of ways that they can handle this. And the well-performing coal plants in the country are really likely to stick around for some period of time.
So this would accelerate a shift to natural gas, in your view, but there's also some elasticity in the price of energy that is produced by coal, in the sense that the coal industry could install cleaner technologies and raise the price of its commodity without producing too much inflation in the system, yes?
You might be right about that. There are clearly ways that coal-fired power plants can get cleaner. It's hard right now to actually install pollution control equipment for carbon pollution, but there are things that coal plants can do on the margin to clean up their act. That said, there is a lot of existing power plant capacity that is already in the ground. It's waiting to be operated. Much of those are natural gas-fired power plants. And if those were run ahead of coal, we could really find that pollution would go down. Plus, there's all sorts of renewable energy. There's existing nuclear plants that are operating. And then there's always energy efficiency, which means that if you don't need to produce as much electricity because demand is down, then that actually is probably the best way to avoid pollution.
What is the precedent for states or for power producers or polluters on any level simply ignoring the EPA?
Well, this part of the Clean Air Act is one that EPA has used in the past. There have not been legal lawsuits on those particular rules, although I must say that those are much smaller in terms of their impact on emitters or polluters across the country. But we do have some experience in situations where EPA has used its authority in this place, which is one where the EPA sets the destination and states figure out how to get there. And they've done that with smog. That's, you know, ground-level pollution that comes from cars. And EPA has had strong enforcement. The EPA has the ability at the end of the day to draft its own plan for a state that doesn't want to get along.
And the question will really be, does the enforcement of these regulations change the resources that the EPA has besides teams of lawyers and the ability to issue edicts? I mean, how much on-the-ground enforcement will have to be done here? That's one of the questions that we'll be looking at. Susan Tierney, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Susan Tierney served as the Assistant Secretary for Policy at the U.S. Department of Energy under President Clinton. She's now a senior advisor at the Analysis Group. Later in the hour, the witches and that's and who's, grammar ghosts that haunt the language and drive some of you crazy. Irregardless is like fingernails on a chalkboard, Amy Taylor writes on Facebook.
This is Marnie from Ferndale. My grammar pet peeve is when people say frustrated instead of frustrated. It drives me crazy.
Tell us the language mistakes you love to hate at 877-8-MY-TAKE or follow us on Twitter. That's at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
There's nothing bigger in global sports than the World Cup, and the 2014 World Cup hysteria gets started later this month in Brazil. In the soccer world, FIFA, the governing body, is something like a cross between the United Nations and the Kremlin. And in this weekend, a report by the Sunday Times in London published damning evidence that FIFA members were bribed and bought off to support Qatar's bid for the 2022 World Cup. There's even talk of Qatar being stripped of the games. And in a separate investigation, our partner, the New York Times, has been reporting on an elaborate match-fixing scheme during the 2010 World Cup in South Africa, where referees were allegedly paid large sums of money to throw matches. Andrew Jennings is the author of Omerta, Sepp Blatter's FIFA Organized Crime Family. Andrew, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello there.
You don't pull any punches about FIFA. How long have you been looking at this organization?
about a dozen years after I'd spent 10 years on the International Olympic Committee and discovered their president, Juan Antonio Samaranch, was a right-arm waving fascist. That's a taboo subject we're not allowed to talk about.
All right, we won't talk about that. So FIFA's problems with the Times of London and the New York Times, what do you make of them?
Well, I think the story in yesterday's London Sunday Times was absolutely brilliant. And like any reporter, I'm as jealous as hell. They have got, they say, hundreds of millions of emails and bank payments and so on, showing that Qatar was systematically paying anybody who moved in FIFA. That New York Times story, I'm sorry, I don't rate it. It's just puffed up completely. It wasn't in the World Cup. It was some alleged qualifying game between two teams you've never heard of, an exhibition game. It doesn't matter.
All right, but still, the idea that referees would be paid on any level is a problem for FIFA, no?
Have you ever jumped a red light? There's a lot of low-level crime around, you know, it shouldn't happen. There are only two big games I know which were fixed that matter, and FIFA fixed them. In the 2002 World Cup in Korea, Koreans, bless their hearts, prefer baseball to soccer. That's their privilege. And as soon as the South Korean team went out of the contest, attendances would slump in the stadia. They had to keep them in to the final 16. And so the Korean team, you know, nothing against them. Good luck. They beat Italy and Spain on match officials' decisions just for economic grounds. It wasn't for the gamblers. It was just to keep the bodies, the bottoms on the seats. And nobody's ever taken FIFA to task for that because the Spanish and Italian people at FIFA, well, they're closer to FIFA than their own countries. And that's a problem you have in America as well.
So you describe FIFA as an organized crime family. And that charge that you just made there certainly indicates that FIFA doesn't care about the purity of soccer and football. It cares much more about maintaining this sort of cash engine called global soccer.
Well, yes. I mean, there's an awful lot of people who do care about the purity of football. I'm one of them. And there's millions and millions more. And many of them are in the United States. I'm an investigative reporter. I'm not a sports reporter. Don't send me to the game. I might get the scoreline wrong. But I started looking at FIFA 12 years ago, and I went sniff, sniff, sniff of my nose. There's something funny going on here. They, you know, they don't publish anything. You can't find out what Sepp Blatter earns. You'd have to nail him to the floor, and then he probably wouldn't tell you. You can't find out. I mean, I know what your president earns. It's online. You can find out as well.
Now, Sepp Blatter is the head of FIFA, I'm gathering.
He is the president of FIFA, and I could smell organized crime. And I looked at the way they operated, and it's very simple. Loyalty comes up from 209 national associations. So what you think, I think, and all the listeners think is irrelevant. As long as Blatter's got 209 national associations kissing his posterior, and one of them is US soccer, then he's, and the Brits, we're just as bad. He's in power, and we can all go take a walk off the plank.
So now, on the Qatar question, the payments presumably were to get over the hurdle that Qatar is a hugely, you know, a desert place where it's really hot in the summer. They're going to have to deal with building a stadium that's cool enough, and they're going to have to shift the timing on all this. Qatar was a low percentage shot to begin with.
Well, that's what you're saying. I would say it slightly differently, is that Qatar is in what the diplomats call the soft power business. They would be very vulnerable to any kind of physical attack from all of the countries around them, so they go on this soft power. They clearly got a World Cup against everybody's disbelief because it is too hot in the summer. And in the winter, it ain't going to happen because the European leagues will refuse to be blocked for 8 weeks. But the people at FIFA don't care. I know, I'm damn sure I know what happened. So do a lot of people. It involved large bags of money, let's put it that way, to take such a bizarre and unacceptable decision. And we've seen a lot of evidence from the Sunday Times yesterday of what they've only so far published, $5 million being handed out to make people happy. There's a lot more stories around. I've looked at a lot more of them. I think more money was spent. Now we've got to get ourselves out of this problem. Just one point on the organized crime I didn't finish on. Having assessed, from my own experience filming against the mafia in Palermo some years ago, I went to Rio de Janeiro, and there I picked up pictures of the previous president of FIFA, João Havelange, sitting at the wedding banquet of the daughter of the biggest gangster in Rio, Castor Andrade. They were mobbed up. FIFA has been mobbed up for a very long time. And this photograph is the crucial evidence. I've got the judge, I've got the prosecutor, they all tell you these things in Rio. Sadly, the football reporters don't go and ask these questions.
Andrew, can you make a comment on the charges that hundreds of Nepalese and foreign workers have died in the construction of the facilities for the Qatar World Cup?
That in itself is good enough. It's true, and it's good enough reason not to go there. And this is another comment on FIFA. They don't care about human rights. Oh, a few hundred construction workers. Why should they care? They're going to make their money. They've got their money. The problem is Sepp Blatter, who's as bad as the rest of them, knows they've got to get out because nobody wants to go to Qatar. Fans don't, players don't, the sponsors don't want to go. You should be getting Coca-Cola, McDonald's and Visa on to say, hey, we really want to go to Qatar and see them.
Yeah, that'll work. We'll try that and we'll see if that happens on tomorrow's program. Andrew Jennings, thanks so much.
Yes, mate.
Andrew Jennings is an investigative journalist specializing in corruption in FIFA, the author of Omerta, Sepp Blatter's FIFA Organized Crime Family. Later in the hour, we're going to talk about grammar rules that get violated. It's not as big a scandal as FIFA, but it makes some of you very, very angry.
This is Thomas McAuley calling from San Antonio, Texas. The thing that bothers me lately, and I've been seeing it more and more, is where somebody asks a question and the other person, instead of just going right to the answer or saying, you know, good question or something like that, they start their answer with so. And my complaint with it is small, but it's irksome because it sounds like the person being asked the question has been interrupted by the person asking it.
Have your say at 877-8MY-TAKE and follow us on Twitter. That's at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And where in the Constitution is there a right to be a jerk?
In this country, people are allowed to be morons. They're allowed to be stupid. They're allowed to think idiotic thoughts.
The allegedly protected right of idiocy, morons, and stupidity principle, invoked there by Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban, might be a little more about how rich people can apparently say anything and do most anything in America. Just look at some of the wisdom of Donald Trump or Sheldon Adelson or the Koch brothers' suspicion of global warming. But Donald Sterling crossed some line on stupidity that the NBA is not going to tolerate. It is set to meet tomorrow to determine if the Sterling family must sell the L.A. Clippers. Donald Sterling, you'll remember, gave up ownership to his wife after a leaked tape showed him making racist comments. Howard Pashman is an assistant professor of history at the University of Notre Dame. He's also a fellow at the Center on the Global Legal Profession at Indiana University's Maurer School of Law. Welcome, Howard.
Hi, good to be with you.
So the right to be a moron, I'm not really finding it in the Constitution. I suppose Mark Cuban might be talking about free speech protections here, yes?
I would assume so. I haven't found that right either.
So what is this about? I mean, we're not really talking about, you know, eminent domain. The government isn't taking anybody's property. But what is Cuban's principle here? And how might Sterling actually be protected or have no leg to stand on?
Mr. Cuban's point is that people can say what they want, as you suggest. It's a right of free speech. And whatever they say shouldn't put their right to hold property in peril. People should be able to hold and use and continue to enjoy the benefits of property, regardless of how, I might say, outlandish someone's views are.
But if I were to, you know, create some sort of racially offensive exhibit in my backyard, I mean, the city might have an interest in shutting me down or maybe, you know, kicking me out of the neighborhood, right? Or no?
They might have an interest in doing that, but I'd have a hard time imagining that you could convince all the neighbors that they should do that. And that's what I find so interesting, because there was a time much earlier in American history, particularly during the American Revolution, when unpopular, unpleasant views were the basis for dispossessing people and permanently removing them from a community. And I'm talking about the British Loyalists, who lost all of their property and were either formally banished, that is, through statute, or informally, through the displeasure and aggressive acts of their neighbors, just driven out of town.
I'm wondering if what the NBA is doing here is also related to the old, very ancient and obsolete in many states, chartering of corporations, in the sense that that states chartered all corporations. And if you didn't, live up to some sense of propriety that was determined by the state could revoke your charter and boom, you were out of business.
That's a very good point, particularly since many of those corporations were what was called single-purpose entities, which meant they were formed to do a thing, build a bridge, clear a road, expand a road. And if they didn't do that or did it inappropriately or expanded the scope of their charter, then they would lose it.
So really the question here is going to be how explicit the NBA is in its bylaws about the authority to revoke somebody's ownership of a team versus Donald Sterling's ability to say, hey, I have due process here. You can't confiscate this. And, of course, lurking in the background is the fact that Steve Ballmer is going to hand him $2 billion. So the idea of some sort of community harm here is a little difficult to take.
That's right. The key document is the NBA's operating agreement. So when someone becomes an owner in the NBA, they agree to follow these rules. And if they don't, and if the owners meet certain basic requirements, such as a minimum vote to terminate an owner's control, then I imagine they're within their rights to do that.
Howard Pashman is a visiting assistant professor of history at Notre Dame. He's a fellow at the Center on the Global Legal Profession at Indiana University School of Law. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Our Monday Retro Report takes us back to a pair of smoky trails in the sky over Cape Canaveral. Very chilling. The 1986 launch of the Challenger Space Shuttle, January 28th, a historic mission that ended before it began.
Flight controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction.
Major malfunction.
We have no downlink. Reports from the flight dynamics officer indicate that the vehicle apparently exploded.
What?
Your vehicle has exploded.
We are looking at checking with the recovery forces to see what can be done at this point.
The vehicle has exploded.
An explosion, a major malfunction, the details of which emerged in a famous investigation that showed huge design and engineering flaws in the NASA shuttle program. Brett Sigler is producer and editor at Retro Report. Joins me now. Brett, welcome.
Nice to see you.
It was a crazy moment, I remember. There was a sense that NASA was invulnerable, and boy, that was dashed on that particular day.
It's true. Leading up to Challenger, I mean, NASA, there was a culture of almost invulnerability there. I mean, with the, Apollo 13, the famous line was even their failures were successes. I mean, the astronauts in Apollo 13, by every right, should have also died, but they succeeded against, really against all odds. So I think that there was really a can-do culture there, unlike something most of us are familiar with, I think.
But the investigation showed, and this is really, really interesting, Alan J. McDonald, who's a contractor from Morton Thiokol that was responsible for that O-ring on the solid fuel rockets that was found to be the problem, that culture of invincibility created a management problem that Alan McDonald really refers to here.
NASA pressured the folks at Thiokol to change their mind. And it was clear to me that we finally came back and gave them what they wanted to hear.
Now, is that the full story of what happened with the O-ring, as far as you can tell?
Not what I found. You know, certainly in the moment after the explosion, there was an investigation. The Rogers Commission came out with their findings, which, you know, pointed a lot of blame, obviously, at the technological failings, which were the O-rings, but also, you know, NASA being under this sort of general schedule pressure to launch. But I think in hindsight, when you sort of look what was happening there, it wasn't about like managers sort of acting amorally at NASA and just sort of pushing this through it at all costs. They were really sort of enforcing rules that existed within NASA. It's just that those rules were bad.
And those rules allowed errors to move up the chain, and it allowed a launch to happen even when something like this was lurking in the background.
Correct. They knew about the history of erosion on O-rings prior to Challenger. It was a well-documented concern with the shuttle, but it had never been catastrophic up to that point. The shuttle system was entirely reusable. So every time they launched a shuttle into space, you know, the rocket boosters would fall off into the ocean. They would retrieve the rocket boosters and they would rehab them and send them back up into space. That's one of the ways that they were trying to make the whole program cost effective, which was a big sort of deal for the shuttle program. So up until Challenger, they had two O-rings. The second O-ring was initially supposed to be a fail-safe. So, you know, the O-rings would keep the rocket fuel within the booster so that it wouldn't breach the side of the rocket and cause an explosion. So what they'd been seeing before Challenger on, you know, numerous occasions was that the rocket fuel was passing the primary O-ring, but it wasn't going past the secondary O-ring. The secondary O-ring stopped it each time. So they knew it was an issue, but they weren't totally sure exactly what was causing it. They knew temperature was involved, but they weren't sure how involved. And because it hadn't been catastrophic, they weren't sure that it was so critical. So they would sort of address the problem, and it would kind of go away, and then it would come back, but it was never critical. So because it never became catastrophic, rather than shutting the whole program down and redesigning the joint, they essentially issued waivers that allowed for some erosion to happen and still make it okay to fly.
Loss of innocence for NASA. Did the organization recover?
It's a difficult question. I think in hindsight, now that we're past the shuttle program, I would say not entirely. In my experience with NASA, NASA is full of very smart, very capable, very intelligent engineers, people in general. And with Challenger, they found themselves in a very unfortunate situation. I think that people really were trying to follow the rules, but the rules were bad.
Brett Ziegler is the producer and editor at Retro Report. If you want to see a video of the findings, you can visit thetakeaway.org. Brett, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The city of Seattle is combining city politics with economic theory today by raising its minimum wage to $15 an hour. Washington State already boasts the highest minimum wage in the country at $9.32 an hour. But a $15 minimum wage would put Seattle at twice the federal level. The $15 level is championed by a coalition of labor activists and some multimillionaires who believe the key to prosperity in an affluent, progressive city like Seattle is a healthy middle class. Nevertheless, this is a cautious step that will be rolled out slowly. Joining us now, Deb Wong, reporter for member station KUOW in Seattle. Thanks for joining us, Deb.
Hey, John.
So how much is this a theory that they're trying to sort of experiment on the workers in Seattle, and how much of this is really a campaign promise being delivered on?
Well, it definitely is a campaign promise. This was something that really, you know, people have been talking about here for years, just like in the rest of the country. You know, the notion of the income disparity between poor and rich. But in November, it became more of a reality when voters in the city of SeaTac, which is just south of Seattle, voted for a $15 an hour minimum wage for certain businesses around the airport. And then at the same time in November, we elected a mayor, Mayor Ed Murray, who campaigned with a promise of raising the minimum wage in Seattle. And then more crucially, at the same time, we elected our first socialist city council member, Shama Sawant. We haven't had a socialist here in 100 years. And she campaigned almost exclusively with the idea that she would bring the $15 an hour minimum wage to Seattle immediately. And she has been a game changer in the city, which tends to like its politics very polite. She has been kind of a bulldog, you know, street fighter for $15 an hour. And we have a little bit of tape of her campaigning for this. You can hear what she sounds like.
Let us not have any illusions. This is class struggle. Business will fight back. They have tens of millions of dollars that they can pour into a counterattack overnight, and they can kill this entire thing if we let them.
So what sort of political clout does she have on the city council? Does she have aspirations beyond her current role?
Well, she has very little clout in the sense that she is sort of the single vote on the left end of the council. But what she does is she commands a rather large grassroots movement. She put together thousands of people to campaign for a very aggressive $15 an hour plan. And they've been collecting signatures to put that plan on the ballot this November. So in a way, this threat of having a ballot initiative, actually a charter amendment on the ballot this November, has kind of made other people in the political establishment move much more quickly because they wanted to put something out that was more moderate and more potentially acceptable to the body politic than what she was working on, which is much more radical.
Well, certainly the labor interests in King County there in Seattle are really happy about this. Listen.
This is about the workers. This is about the employees. This is about creating consumers and taxpayers. This is about who deserves a respectable wage. And there seems to be this notion that some jobs deserve poverty wages. I ask you to take this step to address that.
That's Dave Freiboth. He's the head of the King County Labor Council, which is a kind of consortium of all the labor unions here. But yeah, labor has taken a really strong position on this. They were behind the SeaTac initiative last year. It was mostly the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, that spearheaded that. And they have been really pushing for this $15 an hour wage. They're going to have a big party today, assuming that it's passed finally this afternoon. And they want to see this rolled out, not just in Seattle, but across the country.
Now, I suspect there are some small business owners who won't be at that party.
Yeah, and you know, the interesting thing is when the mayor, the first thing that the mayor did when he took office was he convened this big group of business and labor and nonprofits to sit down and hash out a plan that would be acceptable to all of them. He basically locked them in the room and said, don't come out until you come up with something. And he gave them a very, very strict deadline. And they did come up with this plan, which was, you know, acceptable to a lot of people, but not fully embraced by either community, really. But a lot of businesses, small businesses in particular, have really been upset about this because they feel like their interests were not represented at the table. There was a lot of pushback from restaurants, for example, from other low-margin businesses, and they question really how many of them can survive. So here's a guy named Russell Hollick. He's 28 years old, and he owns a Subway franchise in Seattle.
For a small business who I just started. What will that do? I've already had the bank ask me, hey, what's going to happen in Seattle? Well, I don't know. Well, we're looking at your P&Ls. We're looking at everything. Well, what are you going to do? The landlords asked me the same question. What's going to happen?
What are P&Ls?
Profit and loss statements. I mean, restaurants, we learned through this whole debate, restaurants have very, very low margins. And so if any businesses go out of business, it might be restaurants first.
But this directly addresses the issues that workers in restaurants like Subway have been making around the nation, that they want wages to rise and that they want to have a living wage if they're going to work at these fast food places.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole thing started really in the fast food workers movement, and with these strikes that happened last year, that really lit the fire under a lot of elected officials' feet in Seattle. And the hope is, I mean, in the city of Seattle, even though it's a very wealthy city, there are an estimated 100,000 people here who make less than $15 an hour, and so proponents of this are saying this will lift thousands and thousands of people in the city of Seattle alone out of poverty.
A $15 an hour minimum wage, the prospect in Seattle. Deb Wong is a reporter for Seattle's KUOW. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
On the English language, Geoffrey Chaucer once said this: "You know, eke, that in form of speech is change within a thousand year, and words, though that hadn't price, now wonder nice and strange. Us think in him, and yet they spake him so, and speed as well in love as men now do." I guess he's saying in barely comprehensible Middle English that language tends to change over time. And it's still changing.
This is Crystal from Wichita Falls, Texas. I hate when people say I could care less instead of I couldn't care less.
Emma writes this on Facebook: when people use I thinking they sound smart when in reality they should be saying me, sometimes me is correct. Anna hates confusing less and fewer. Tallahassee, Florida is bugged by a lot of sloppy grammar. There are too many to list, but ending a sentence with at is a leader. Yikes, Tallahassee, I'm guilty of that. Former dictionary editor Ammon Shea says we're all guilty of fiddling with the language rules. There's a long history of grammar and spelling errors becoming common usage, despite the outrage of the self-appointed language police. It's the story told in his new book, Bad English, A History of Linguistic Aggravation.
Everybody who's ever had to suffer through trying to read Beowulf or anything that's more than 100 years old in English prose knows that the language changes. Words mean different things. But one of the things I think is often overlooked is that the rules that ostensibly govern our language change as well. And yet we frequently hear people who like to correct others and who say things like, well, I care about language. That's something, a phrase you hear frequently right before you get a scolding, which is, I care about language, which to me is kind of a mildly euphemistic way of saying, I like to tell other people that they're wrong.
Yes.
And, you know, if you're going to tell people that, if that's what you like to do, at least be honest about it.
You actually give us a sense of the history here. I love at the end, you've got 221 words that were once frowned upon.
Sure.
And hospitalize, that's a word that we just don't even think about
well,
anymore.
Sure. It's,
and but look, hospitalize, as the literate know, is no more capable of meaning send to a hospital than canalize is of meaning throw into a canal. Lord Coensford, you Americans are murdering the language.
Yes.
From the Saturday Evening Post in 1957. Yeah,
Lord Coensford really disliked what the Americans were doing to what he thought was his personal language. But he's not unusual in that. I mean, one of the other ones that I love is a number of language commentators in the early 20th century said you should never use dilapidated to refer to anything except for a stone house.
Oh, lapis. Okay.
Because it comes from lapis. So any fool knows that. I mean, this couldn't possibly apply to a wood house, right? And of course, we don't pay any attention to that now.
So. Who is Richard Grant White?
Richard Grant White is what I would refer to in clinical terms as an utter idiot, who, however, was blessed with a classical education and an overwhelming desire to correct the language of other people in the second half of the 19th century.
British or American?
He was American.
He was American.
And, yes, and he wrote two books, Words and Their Uses, I believe, is the name of the first one.
And this is from Words and Their Uses. He right. goes after the word jeopardize.
Sure. He hated it.
Among the monsters is none more frequently met than with jeopardize, a foolish and intolerable word which has no rightful place in the language.
Right. Well, to be honest, he wrote that way about almost everything. So this is not a particular word that he hated. He said the same thing about ice cream. Ice cream should be iced cream with a D. Photographer was something that only fools say, because anybody who knows anything about Latin and Greek should know it's photographist. He thought that real estate was a ludicrous introduction from the realm of law. He's one of the more extreme examples, but some of the things that he's saying are really no more extreme than the things that people today say.
You know, I'm constantly reminded of how old I am working with, you know, a staff that's all in their 20s on this show, but you reminded me that my rules for using which and that and which and who come from the 1800s. I thought I was current. You know, who is only used with a person, which is only with a thing. That is not even the rule anymore.
Yeah, and well, you know, one of the other things that's funny about which and who, and it has a lot to do with restrictive and non-restrictive relative clauses and other things that you can easily use to put yourself to sleep at night. But if you really don't want to bother with any of it, you can just really take heart in the fact that most British people don't distinguish between them very much at all. So you could always just say you're affecting a Britishism or something if you get it wrong.
What do you think the changing rules of the language say about our culture?
I think that changing rules mean that our language is healthy. Healthy languages change. Dead languages do not change. That's very, very simple. It's been long established. I think the fact that people dislike change is really just a sign of the human condition. We want consistency, and we're never going to find it in language. But a lot of times people have a favorite word. You know, an example of this would be that a word has a special meaning, and they think that when it's used in a broadened sense, you're debasing the word, which is really nonsense. But I understand that people like words to hold on to their meanings. For instance, they want literally to mean only in a literal fashion and not in a figurative fashion.
Yeah, do not use it when you plainly do not mean it, as in the sentence, I was literally tickled to death. So unless you're laughing and dead, you shouldn't use literally there.
So people think that literally is losing something of its innocence when people use it figuratively. However,
I think that's kind of right, though.
Well, it is right as long as you're prepared to be consistent. And the problem with saying that literally has to mean that is that it's had several other meanings, a number of which actually precede the favored use of literally. So the first use of literal was letter by letter, meaning you would copy something letter by letter. So we're already getting into an expanded use.
You know, some of the stories in here are not about the explicit meanings of a word, but the word's backstory.
Mm-hmm.
This is fascinating to me. Polite. This word is much used by persons of doubtful culture, where those of the better sort use the word kind. We accept kind, not polite invitation.
Sure.
Alfred Ayers, the verbalist, 1894. So a polite invitation is like you rabble, you toothless. I mean, what?
Yeah, that's more or less how they would have viewed you, or some people would have viewed you. One of the things that's really delightful about looking back at, you know, usage guides and style guides to the English language over the past 100 years is that you realize that we're constantly breaking these rules, you know, and that it is quite impossible to pay attention to all of them. There are such degrees of specificity in language that some people expect that you cannot please everybody.
Mm.
We are all of us breaking someone's rules.
Your worst grammatical sin?
I would say that it is my insistence on using the word stupider, which in my defense, I have to say, stupider is formed as a disyllabic adjective. It ends with a velar alveolar stop, which in the eyes of the linguist means it's the same kind of thing as politer or solider, and nobody seems to chastise us for that. So I insist on using stupider, and people insist on thinking that I am, in fact, stupider for it.
Which is exactly the argument a stupid person would use right. to justify the use of stupider, I would think. For me, my mother goes crazy when I put the word at the end of a sentence.
Oh, you mean the terminal preposition?
Yeah.
You know, people have been arguing against that for, since 1646.
If I do it on the air, I get an immediate phone call.
Well, can I tell your mother on the air that there is absolutely nothing wrong with putting any sort of preposition at the end of a sentence? This has been established by essentially every usage and grammar guide of the past 150 years. Strunk and White says it's fine. The American Heritage Dictionary says it's fine.
So, Mom, wherever you're at, just listen. It's totally okay what I'm saying. Ammon Shea, thanks so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
You've certainly changed my life. Ammon Shea is a former dictionary editor for Oxford University Press and author of the book Bad English, A History of Linguistic Aggravation. The aggravation starts tomorrow. San Geronimo, California isn't buying the preposition proposition there. My skin crawls every time I hear a sentence ending in a preposition. And don't get me started on confusing good and well. Go for it. It's good and well to hear your most hated grammar lapses. Tell us at 877-8MYTAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Whatever. This is The Takeaway.